let me call you back.
That was Albert Woodfox, and that's where we're going to have to leave it until we speak to him live on Democracy Now! I want to thank Robert King, a member of the Angola 3. We will continue our conversation and post it online at democracynow.org. And Corrine Williams, the lawyer for Albert Woodfox, an attorney with the firm Squire Patton Boggs. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Tune in to KBOO Monday, November 24th at 7 p.m. for another episode of the Steam Radio Syndicate. For their second broadcast exploring traditional folk songs, the Steam Radio Syndicate takes on a classic ballad telling the tale of John Henry, a folk hero and steel-driving man. Poems, songs, and history converge for an hour-long live broadcast, bringing together 30 performers and musicians for a special one-time event. That's Monday, November 24th at 7 p.m. for Steam Folk, The Ballad of John Henry. Sound and stories from the deck of the UV-746 tugboat on the Willamette River, right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Then they're going by, picking up a little speed. Clickety-clack, clickety-clack, clickety-clack.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
Oh, pirates, yes, steam rabbi.
Hear poetry from the prisoners at the Oregon State Penitentiary.
Hood anthems become multi-million dollar commercial jingles. But the question is, who's getting paid and who's really getting played? Such a volatile minefield.
In this world of cold concrete and lifeless steel, there is no warmth here, no affection, no touch.
But more than the cacophonous conversation, I crave the pleasure of feeling myself. I need you to keep me sensitive.
Hear the Uhuru Sasa Poetry Share on Prison Pipeline, November 24th at 6:30 p.m.
Triumphantly, won't you help me sing? Song of freedom.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on KBOO Evening News, the grand jury in Ferguson, Missouri has made their decision on the indictment of Officer Darren Wilson for the killing of Michael Brown in August. The prosecutor's office has delayed the public announcement of the decision, which is now expected around 6 p.m. Pacific time.
Native Americans continue their blockade of a Kinder Morgan pipeline in British Columbia, despite mass arrests by Canadian police.
We'll hear from a student at PSU who is at the University Board of Trustees meeting right now as they discuss the option of arming campus security.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 24th, 2014. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Ani. The state prosecuting attorney is set to announce whether Officer Darren Wilson will be indicted today in the shooting of Michael Brown. In anticipation, the governor of Missouri has spoken to the press, urging for peace and thoughtful response to the announcement. We have that audio for you here today.
Good evening. I'm pleased to be joined this evening by St. Louis Mayor Francis Slay, St. Louis County Executive Charlie Dooley, and Missouri Director of Public Safety Dan Isom. Later this evening, the St. Louis County Prosecutor will announce the grand jury's decision. While none of us knows what that will be, our shared hope and expectation is that regardless of the decision, people on all sides show tolerance mutual respect, and restraint. Earlier today, I visited with some folks in Ferguson, and it's understandable that, like the rest of us, they are on edge waiting for a decision. But they are doing their best to go about their daily lives, conduct their business, and support one another and their community. I also spoke with a number of faith leaders late this afternoon who offered their prayers for peace and safety. Together, we are all focused on making sure the necessary resources are at hand to protect lives, protect property, and protect free speech. Several churches will be providing safe havens throughout the area to provide food, shelter, and medical care. Mental health providers have teamed up to help ease the emotional strain that these events have caused. These health professionals are working right now to provide counseling and other services to the people that need them. Law enforcement officials continue to maintain open lines of communication with protest leaders to improve the interactions between police and demonstrators and prevent violence. I want to thank my Director of Public Safety, Dan Isom, for taking part in these ongoing discussions. State and local law enforcement agencies are continuing to work hand in hand to make sure the best, most experienced officers are on the street. The men and women of the National Guard will also be in the area to provide security at critical facilities like firehouses, police stations, and utility substations, and offer logistical and transportation support as needed. This will help free up law enforcement officers to do their jobs effectively. In closing, I'd like to reiterate my call for peace, respect, and restraint, and thank everyone out there who is working hard to make sure communities throughout the region are safe and secure. Thank you all very, very much.
In addition to this press release, news correspondent Riley Turner spoke today with Carl Dix. He's a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party who wrote a press release regarding Ferguson.
As we anticipate this announcement tonight, what is your prediction for what may happen in Ferguson this evening?
Well, look, all indications have been that they are planning to let this killer cop walk. And if that is what comes down, it will be a stamp of approval from the system on police murder of black youth. And look at the time that it's happening, because in the past several days, police in Cleveland gunned down a 12-year-old black child who had a toy gun. In Brooklyn, police shot a 28-year-old black man who was walking along up the stairs in his apartment building, and the police opened the door, heard someone coming up the steps, a shot rang out, and the man was dead. This is happening all the time, and police are almost never held accountable for what is nothing more than outright murder of people. This has to stop. And the other thing that I predict is that people in Ferguson, but not only in Ferguson, will take to the streets in outrage. They will be determined to raise their voices to say, this must end. Civil disobedience type actions will happen in Ferguson, throughout the St. Louis area, here in New York City, and all across the country. And that's what's needed.
With the mounting remilitarization and the involvement of the National Guard inside Ferguson today, how do you think that the protesters and those who have chosen civil disobedience as their form of protest should go about avoiding harm, if at all possible?
Well, I'm glad you added the "if at all possible," because I just watched the Missouri governor's press conference, and their concern is that there remain order even as their police force continues to brutalize, mistreat, and even kill people. And that's an order that we cannot accept. And people have been in determined acts of protest for more than 100 days in Ferguson. I was there in August and again in October. And in August in particular, the police were very free with their rubber bullets, tear gas, sound cannons, and the rest, not because the protests were violent, but because the protests were calling for an end to police murder in a determined way. And if the police take that tenor, then there's going to be confrontation, chaos, and all the rest. People have a right and a responsibility to say that they will not stand by and allow law enforcement to get away with murder. And that's what people are saying they're determined to do, and I support that. That's why I issued that statement. People can go to the website revcom.us and check out that statement and other things that I've had to say on the situation of police murder, mass incarceration, and the whole slow genocide aimed at Black and Latino people in this country.
Systemically, what do you think needs to happen to avoid a situation like Ferguson again?
Well, what it's going to come down to is it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to end this horror and all the other horrors this system inflicts on people here in this country and around the world, whether that's, you know, stripping women of the right to have an abortion, devastating the environment of the whole planet, drone missile strikes. And people who see these horrors and think they need to end need to stand up and say they need to stop. And look, you don't have to agree with me that revolution is the solution, but if you think these are unjust acts that this society is taking, it's going to be mass determined resistance, political resistance on the part of the people that will stop them. It isn't going to be a question of if we get a Democrat, these things will stop, because we actually have had a Democrat in the White House for, what, 6 years now, and they've continued.
Thank you, Carl Dix, for your time.
Thank you.
That was Carl Dix of the Revolutionary Communist Party from his press release, Eyes on Ferguson. This is Riley Turner with KBOO News.
Protests are planned in cities across the country, including here in Portland at the federal courthouse at Southwest 3rd and Main at 4 o'clock tomorrow. Tune in at 5 o'clock for tomorrow for a full report, including live interviews from Ferguson.
The Portland Police Bureau has ordered three of its officers to take down images from their personal Facebook pages that use the official badge of the Bureau to support Darren Wilson. Darren Wilson is the officer who fatally shot Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Portland Police Chief Mike Reese ordered the three officers to take down the images that showed the official Portland Police badge surrounded by the words, "I am Darren Wilson." The chief stated that the image displayed does not represent the Portland Police Bureau and is inflammatory in nature. In a related story, the hacktivist group Anonymous claims to have identified three Ku Klux Klan members at a rally in support of Wilson. The conflict between Anonymous and the KKK started earlier this weekend when Anonymous seized two of the hate group's Twitter accounts. The accounts were seized after the Klan stated it would use lethal force should violence erupt following the grand jury's decision.
And Ferguson Police Officer Darren Wilson has been having off-the-record meetings with the top network news anchors to decide who will receive his first interview. The list of anchors includes Matt Lauer of NBC, George Stephanopoulos of ABC, and Anderson Cooper of CNN. As a St. Louis grand jury has been deciding whether Mr. Wilson will face charges in the Michael Brown shooting case, he has opted to remain in hiding as opposed to testifying at all. He has never spoken publicly or to the press about killing Michael Brown or the national controversy that's followed.
Portland State University students are gathered right now at a Board of Trustees meeting. They're discussing the potential arming of PSU security guards. Sonia is one of the organizers of the students opposed to the move and spoke with KBOO from the meeting.
We rallied in the park box for a little bit and then marched up to the University Place Hotel where they're having their meeting and packed their meeting room and did a mic check, made a statement about how we feel about this issue and the fact that the board members take about 2 hours to discuss this matter leaving us outside of the conversation. It's a Monday. Many people need to study for finals. So it's a, clearly an undemocratic conversation that's happening. So we took the liberty to express our opinion at the beginning of the meeting. So we made sure that we were heard.
What's the sentiment among the students about arming the police, arming the security guards and making them into a police force there at Portland State University?
Well, from the conversations I've been having when I table, that means like canvassing, it's very opposed. There's so many issues that go into policing and safety. I mean, what kinds of safety are we talking about? If it's pertaining to mental health or sexual assault, there's also an issue of racial profiling. So there's many reasons why people oppose it. A big one is tuition. We're going to spend $1.5 million over the course of 3 years, which is an estimate. From the general funds, meaning they're going to be taking the money that could be going towards education and militarizing our campus. So most students are very opposed.
And what's the sense there at the Board of Trustees meeting? Are they giving reasons that they believe the police, the campus security should be armed?
Yes. A lot of their reasons are grounded in individual situations, and to me it feels like kind of a fear-mongering, because they explain these situations in great detail, like the fact that we had a homeless person who was selling drugs on campus and he had a criminal record. That was emphasized greatly when in situations like an active shooter. That's what's being brought up in the discussion between the board and the people who are trying to push this measure through, which is the chief of campus safety and the vice president of finance and administration. They talk about how we need to prepare our campus for a situation that could potentially be violent. When you look at the crime rates that they list in their report, through which they're trying to push this measure through, we surprisingly have a low amount of violent crimes. Most of the crimes that happen on campus are theft. So our feeling is that they are trying to create an environment that is going to be even more unsafe than they claim it is currently. And we feel that even though there are, like, we're not saying that there aren't any situations that are violent, but if we create an environment in which there's this constant fear that there's going to be violence, people are going to act violently and try to defend themselves against police. And police are going to be making more arrests because there's going to be more of them. So we feel that it's just a very unstable situation that they're trying to create, when we could be investing in things like mental health services, get more counselors, get more people who work in the Women's Resource Center to help rape victims, and things like that, or simple things like having better lighting on campus, having more emergency call boxes. We have 6, and 2 of them don't work. Their solution for everything is to create a police force. That's the only measure that we're hearing about.
What parallels do you see between the potential arming of the Portland State University security force and what the nation is awaiting this evening, the verdict in Ferguson of the grand jury on whether to indict Officer Darren Wilson for shooting an unarmed black man?
This has been something that we have been talking about since we have known about Ferguson. During the summer, we felt that this is going to be a very hot issue on our campus. because of the awareness that's been raised through the Ferguson protests, and Gaza as well was a big topic this summer. So, yes, there's a clear line between the militarization of cities, and now it's spreading to campuses. This is all evidence of state entities trying to gear up and prepare for the worst. One of the most upsetting things to us is that none of our departmental resources have been used in the course of the creation of this report. So we have one of the most amazing programs in conflict resolution in the country, and it hasn't been talked about. None of the professors have been reached out to from that department. We also have psychology, criminology, Black studies, women's gender studies, and none of those people participated in the presidential task force or had any input into creating safety measures at our school.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Sonia, who is speaking to us from the Board of Trustees meeting at Portland State University, a university hotel. Thank you so much for joining us. We're talking about the creation of an armed police force on the campus of Portland State University. This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Overwhelmed by what was happening in Ferguson, Missouri, two Atlanta area men decided they had to do something. Although neither were avid runners, they made the decision to run 540 miles from Atlanta, Georgia to Ferguson, Missouri. The two men took a few weeks to train before embarking on a journey that has taken them through five states in rain, sleet, hail, and snow over 20 days, running and walking about 35 miles per day, leading them to the Michael Brown Memorial in Ferguson, where the teen was shot. They hope to be an inspiration, saying that statistically, it seemed like in their community, quote, we Black men are incarcerated or doing nothing. They wanted to go against the grain and not be another statistic, and wanted to inspire others to do the same.
Color of Change, an organization that supports the strengthening of Black voices in media, has called for local and national media to be mindful of the way they are covering the upcoming announcement and subsequent actions taken in Ferguson. Many mainstream news outlets have been accused recently of referring to the predominantly Black protesters as rioters, thugs, looters, and even animals. In an effort to maintain equality in reporting, Color of Change stresses that the acts of looting and violent rioting are from fringe extremists and that the majority of protesters are doing so peacefully and constitutionally. The press release further states that the rearming of local police forces and the state of emergency called by Missouri Governor Jay Nixon are clearly seeking a worst-case scenario result. They ask that news media do their best to prevent the promotion of a violent end to the Ferguson protests.
After gaining a seat in both the State House and the Senate, Democrats in the Oregon legislature have the opportunity to advance legislation regarding gun control, voting rights, and the environment. Environmental legislation may include an extension of the low carbon fuel standard. Although the standard is not new, it was never fully implemented in the old legislature. Gun control advocates have indicated that they are now willing to push for stricter background checks. A bill would have required background checks for private gun sales fell short earlier this year. Secretary of State Kate Brown's effort to automatically register hundreds of thousands of new voters via driving records may also be helped by the recent Democratic gains.
Police have released the identity of a woman who they shot and killed Thursday when she confronted them with a rifle. The boyfriend of Chelsea B. Fresh called police Thursday after she pushed him over and went for a knife in the kitchen. He feared she would harm herself or others. Chelsea did speak to a crisis negotiator and went in and out of her apartment several times, carrying a rifle. She then exited her apartment, pointed the rifle at police, who then opened fire and killed her, killing her at the scene. Chelsea Fresh's boyfriend told police that she had no ammunition for the rifle, but police spokesman Mike Rowe claims that Chelsea told the crisis negotiator that she did. The officers involved have not been identified. They are currently on administrative leave, as is procedure for a police shooting.
It appears that Oregon ballot measure 92, which requires the labeling of foods that contain genetically modified ingredients, is headed for recount. As of noon today, the Secretary of State's office reported that the no votes outspaced yes votes by a margin of only 809 votes, out of a total of over 1.5 million votes counted. Oregon counties had until 5 p.m. today to provide final official vote tallies on all races that were on the November 4th ballot. There will be no official decision on a Measure 92 recount until the first week of December. For more information, KBOO's Ken Jones spoke with Tony Green, Communications Director for the Oregon Secretary of State.
Tony, what is the latest tally for Oregon Measure 92?
The last time I checked our website, about 800 votes were separating no from yes. The measure is still failing, but there's about an 800 vote difference.
And is there a deadline for all counties to submit their vote counts?
Yeah, they must have their vote counts done by the end of the day today.
If there is a recount necessary, what would automatically trigger one?
It's one-fifth of 1%, which in this race would be about 3,000 votes. Obviously, currently they are well within that margin.
The assumption is there probably will be a recount, but of course that's not been officially declared. After today's votes are in at the 5 o'clock deadline, do you know when a recount would be officially declared?
As soon as we can certify the results as accurate, we will then be able to call for a recount.
And is there a timetable for that? Does the state legislature require a certain time limit, or is that indefinite?
Well, our deadline, our office has a deadline of December 4th. We anticipate completing the task sooner than that.
When the task is completed, what is the process then? I guess I don't really know what a recount entails. Every single vote that has been submitted, then the Secretary of State's office goes again and confirms that vote was yes or no?
Not quite. The counties do it, and it's a hand count as opposed to a machine count. So you'll have people looking over each ballot and determining how the ballot, whether it's a yes, no, or whether they didn't pick either one.
Now, I've already seen some publicity from groups like Yes on Measure 92 that are asking for volunteers, both lawyers and non-lawyers, to observe the recounts by the counties. That must be allowed, I would guess.
A member of both the pro and the anti-measure campaigns are entitled to observe the counting in each county.
So these observers then could just kind of look over the shoulders of the person who's counting them at each county and confirm whether the vote was accurately recorded as a yes or a no?
That's correct.
That seems like a very painstaking process. Is there a time limit on when the counties have to submit the final votes of a recount, if there is a recount?
There is no statutory deadline. The law says that it is practical.
And the recount, when the results are available, those are official then. Either the measure at that point either passes or it doesn't?
That is correct.
No side then can appeal and ask for an additional recount, even if they offer to pay for it.
Well, you're getting ahead of us. All I know is what the next step in the process is. I think I don't want to, at this point, we haven't looked beyond the most immediate issue, which is how would a recount look?
And then just out of curiosity, and I know this won't be official, but when will a final count, pre-recount, be available for people to look at on the website today?
As soon as the counties are done.
And that's at 5 o'clock today.
No later than.
Several counties, if not the majority of them, have already submitted votes. Do you know which counties have yet to submit additional votes?
I don't know which counties are still out there, no.
We've been talking with Tony Green, Communications Director for the Oregon Secretary of State, for an update on the ballot measure 92 vote count. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for Labor Radio at 6 p.m., followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30. Tonight's show features the Uhuru Sasa Poetry Share at the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. At 7, it's a special live broadcast from a boat on the Willamette River. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy in the morning in the Portland area, with a high of 58 and a low of 51. Today in history, on November 24th, 1971, during a severe thunderstorm over Washington State, a hijacker calling himself D.B. Cooper parachuted from a Northwest Orient Airlines plane with $200,000 in ransom money. He has never been found. The quote of the day is from civil rights activist Malcolm X, who said, "Concerning nonviolence, it is criminal to teach a man not to defend himself when he is the constant victim of brutal attacks."
It's 5:30, and that means it's time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
Gabillionaires who invest in hedge funds generally have the ethical and aesthetic sensibilities of dirt clods. As far as they care, fund managers can put their money into skunk pelt futures as long as the investment pays a super fat return. But since Wall Street's 2008 crash revealed that so many of these investment schemes were based on nothing more than financial cobwebs and fairy dust, some of the clods began seeking hedge funds that would invest in something more down to earth. Thus, Wall Street discovered dirt, more specifically, farmland. Such money handlers as BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, now offer big pieces of America's heartland as an asset that super-rich penthouse dwellers can own and till for mega profits. As a result, ag professors report that their Farm Belt conferences on land economics, which normally draw an audience of farmers and local farm lenders, are dominated these days by Wall Streeters, and American farmland investment seminars are even being held in Dubai and Singapore. But this Wall Street land rush is a flimsy fad, for it's not based on economic realities. While crop prices are at record highs today, the painful historic record is that they will plummet tomorrow, destroying the cash flow that makes the hedge fund investment in land work. Then, of course, the gabillionaires will rush to shed their overalls. But who will line up to buy the land? Certainly not real farmers who can't afford the inflated Wall Street price, and especially not young people who want to farm but are already finding it hard to locate affordable land. This is Jim Hightower saying America desperately needs this next generation of food producers. Yet we're letting Wall Street speculators literally wall off the land they need. To learn more, contact the National Young Farmers Coalition at youngfarmers.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
This weekend, a group of Portlanders gathered at the local Veterans Administration Hospital to discuss the issue of Agent Orange and its continued impact on veterans. KBOO's Doug McVeigh was there and spoke with one of the participants.
Tom Owen, you're the Vietnam Veterans of America down here in Oregon. Just finished a town hall. Could you tell me something about these events? You're doing a series of them around the country, and there's a few in Oregon so far?
That's true. We've done 115 of them now around the country. This is our, I believe, 12th here in Oregon. And what these town halls are about is about the long-term and the generational effects of our exposures to Agent Orange when we were in Vietnam.
Now, give me an idea of the scope. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who were affected. Is that actually minimizing the number?
Well, at this point, it's minimizing the number because we are tracking 18 birth defects into the third generation, so the number gets larger. See, the Vietnam veteran has 22 presumptive diseases connected to our exposures. And like I said, we're now tracking 18 birth defects into the third generation. We have no idea when it's going to stop because they keep getting worse. As you heard here today, it's not actually a birth defect. The dioxin in the Agent Orange modified our DNA. So it's going to go on and on.
Sorry, got a little choked up. That'll happen. If I start to do that again, just talk.
Okay.
It was quite a good crowd that you had. Got into the third generation. people need to find out more, where would they get in touch to, where should, what's your website, where should they get in touch? Vietnam Vets in the city of Portland and in the state of Oregon, where should they go?
Well, the first place they should go if they're looking for more information is vva.org. There's probably close to 1,000 links on that site that will give you information about Agent Orange and what's going on. Here in Oregon, we have a website for VVA Oregon, and that'll come up, and you'll get a lot of information there.
And it's not just, and you were saying, it's not just the vets who were in country, boots on the ground. Even the even Navy folks who were stationed, who were offshore, were exposed.
Correct. The Blue Water Navy guys are affected. A lot of people that were affected that never went over into that area, but they were using it so much around their camps here in this country. Fort McClellan was one of them. And they, there's a lot of cases of Agent Orange contamination right just from being stationed in this country.
So we're really talking Vietnam era vets, not only the ones who
Correct.
Went over. Wow. And this is the kind of thing that continues. I know one or two speakers mentioned the burn pits. I'm only starting to hear about that stuff from the news, but
the burn pits are going on with the guys that are serving active duty right now. But the founding principle of the Vietnam Veterans of America was never again will one generation of veterans abandon another. And so a lot of the work we're doing, making people aware of these toxic exposures, are actually benefiting our younger brother and sisters that are currently serving.
Tom, thank you for the work you're doing. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Well, actually, a lot of people say, well, why do you do that? I do it because I'm pissed off. I'm an angry guy. You know, that the government would do this, you know, and then not take care of the veterans properly. I go to the Hill quite a bit in Washington. I tell them all the same story. You know, as far as I'm concerned, you have two options. You can either properly take care of your veterans, or you can stop making them. I'm good either way. You know, but if you're going to make them, take care of them.
That was the voice of Tom Owens, one of the Portland veterans who participated in a forum this past weekend on the impact of Agent Orange.
An anonymous letter sent by FBI agents to Dr. Martin Luther King in 1964 urged for the civil rights leader to commit suicide. That same letter also referred to Dr. King as, quote, an evil, abnormal beast, end quote, among other insults. The same note was previously released in a highly edited version that omitted many of the said invectives. It contained detailed knowledge of Dr. King's extramarital affairs and threatened to expose him if he did not commit suicide. Dr. Martin Luther King initially suspected the letter was sent by the FBI, although it was intended to be anonymous. He did not allow the threats to dissuade him from being a civil rights leader. It was not until about a decade later that the truth started to come out about the threatening letter. And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, November 24th, 2014. Palestinian man shot and killed by Israeli troops in Gaza, and an Israeli settler injures a Palestinian child in Jerusalem. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian child was injured on Monday afternoon when an Israeli settler hit him with his car in East Jerusalem. Khalil Al-Kiswani, 14, was moved to hospital with a broken leg after being hit by the settler's car. Witnesses said that the boy was able to run away from the settler's car bath after he was hit the first time. Staying in Jerusalem, Israeli soldiers stormed the homes of Ghassan Abu Jamal and his cousin Uday and took measurements in preparation for demolishing the two homes. Clashes erupted between invading troops and local youth. No injuries were reported. Ghassan and Uday were killed last Tuesday when they attacked a religious school for Israeli settlers in Jerusalem, killing 8, including 2 soldiers. The Israeli police still refuses to hand over the bodies of Ghassan and Uday to their families. Elsewhere, groups of armed Israeli settlers attacked on Monday Palestinian cars at a number of roads near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Damage was reported, but no injuries. Also near Nablus, Israeli soldiers invaded the town of Hawara and searched homes, then clashed with local youth. Troops imposed a curfew for a few hours before leaving the town. Residents told local media that troops fired tear gas at residents' homes, causing damage. In Gaza, Palestinian medical sources have reported that a man was shot and killed by Israeli army fire east of Jabalia in the northern part of the Gaza Strip on Sunday. In addition, a Palestinian teen was shot and wounded by army fire in Rafah, southern Gaza Strip, on Sunday as well. Eyewitnesses said that the Israeli soldiers stationed at a military tower across the border fence east of Jabalia shot and killed Fadl Hilwa and targeted other Palestinians in the area. They said Hilwa was hunting birds when the soldiers shot and killed him. Hilwa is the first Palestinian in Gaza to be killed by the Israeli army since the ceasefire agreement was reached 3 months ago, ending 50 days of Israeli sea, ground and aerial bombardment, which left more than 2,100 Palestinians killed and over 12,000 others injured. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, November 24th, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
Protests continue today in British Columbia as Native American activists and supporters maintain a blockade to stop Kinder Morgan Corporation from drilling on Native land. The drilling operation is part of a planned oil pipeline through British Columbia by Kinder Morgan. The site in question, Burnaby Mountain, is considered a sacred site to Native nations in that area, and they have set up a blockade off the road up the mountain. More than 50 people have been arrested since police cracked down on Thursday. But yesterday saw some of the largest numbers of supporters who came out to support the Burnaby Mountain blockade. Over the weekend, Native activists tending the sacred fire got support from an unlikely source, members of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, or the Mounties, who helped bring firewood up the hill to the fire. Legendary environmental leader David Suzuki walked up to the police line on Sunday and delivered this message.
I did want to start by speaking to the RCMP first. To the RCMP, I come before you with grave respect, but now you are here to enforce the law. That does not mean that you are above the law or that you make your own law. My grandson was dragged across the line yesterday or the day before and arrested. You're breaking the law. And I'm disappointed. I am disappointed. It grieves me because of the respect we hold for you. That's our problem. If we continue to look at the land and the world around us just in terms of dollars and cents, we are going to destroy the very things that make that land so precious to us, the very things that keep us alive and healthy. That's what this battle is about. Thank you for coming.
And that was David Suzuki, who spoke at the protest at Burnaby Mountain in Canada. They are engaged in an ongoing blockade to stop the Kinder Morgan oil drilling and pipeline on sacred Native land.
The New York Times has revealed that President Obama has secretly issued new classified orders extending combat missions for U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Last May, President Obama vowed that U.S. troops would not engage in active combat duties in Afghanistan beyond this year. The new decision allows U.S. troops to continue military operations in Afghanistan into 2015 and beyond. The decision exposed a rift between civilian advisors to the president and top U.S. military leaders. Two major areas of concern are believed to have influenced President Obama's change in the level of military operations in Afghanistan. increased suicide bombings there and the rise of ISIS in Iraq and Syria are the reasons provided by U.S. officials for the increase in troops. Another key reason for the extension of combat roles for U.S. troops was the September presidential elections in Afghanistan. The outgoing president, Hamid Karzai, has refused to allow U.S. troops to remain there in a combat role beyond this year due to popular widespread protests over civilian deaths. Karzai had also put a ban on nighttime raids by U.S. special troops due to the large civilian casualty count. The new president, Ashraf Ghani, has reversed both decisions by Karzai, allowing U.S. special forces to engage in night raids and approving continued U.S. combat activities into the next year. Ghani is much closer to United States interests than the former president, Karzai. Educated at Columbia University in the United States, Ghani worked for the World Bank for over a decade. He then returned to Afghanistan in December 2001 in the aftermath of the U.S. invasion and the removal of the Taliban government. At 13 years and counting, the Afghanistan war has become the longest war that the U.S. has ever been involved with. Polls reveal that fewer than half of Americans believe the war was worth the price, and fewer than 30% believe the war has made America safer. The total cost of the Afghanistan war to U.S. taxpayers is expected to exceed several trillion dollars. Kathy Kelly spoke about the new deployment of troops to Afghanistan on KBOO's Air Cascadia this morning.
The decision to have a limited combat troop presence remain in Afghanistan for another year was made some weeks ago, and it may be that because they didn't want to release the news before the elections, it was kept secret, and then it was leaked to the New York Times on Friday night, a time when it might be presumed that there wouldn't be a lot of news coverage. And so it's pretty clear, I think, that President Obama has been obeisant to the demands of the National Security Agency, maybe the CIA and the Pentagon generals. The Pentagon is asking for